This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Hey, what's up, everybody? It's Dirt. I want to thank you for taking some time out to listen to the podcast of our show, brought to you by Les Schwab Tires, doing the right thing since 1952.
It's time for a noon kick.
And as they say in Tinseltown, roll up.
This is a Football Friday edition of Dirt and Sprague.
They had pride. They had talent. They had hats and t-shirts.
Dirt and Sprague on Football Friday.
Tapped by Coors Light. Ducks fans, as you power up for game day, grab some frost-brewed Coors Light, the world's most refreshing beer. Please drink responsibly.
Dirt and Sprague on 1080 The Fan.
All right, it is 12:02. It's time for Dirt and Sprague on Football Friday here on 1080 The Fan. Brandon Sprague, Andy Eater Johnson in with you. On this beautiful afternoon we've got going on here in the 503. Still fresh off the highest viewed Thursday night football game since 15. Baker Mayfield and the Jets.
That was the number one game since 2015.
For Thursday night football, everybody was in on watching Baker Mayfield pull off the magic against Sammy D and his J-E-T-S, Jets, Jets, Jets.
That was the best Thursday night game that I can remember since...
The 49er-Rams game about a year or two ago really sticks out.
I have no recollection of that game for some reason.
You remember that one? It came down to the wire. The Rams won. It was like 42-39
yes,
or something.
Yes, I do. Yes.
That was
yes.
A good game.
High scoring. Nobody could stop anybody.
Yeah.
I want to say that was either last year or the year before or something like that.
I get it mixed up because I moved, so I always forget the last two seasons, like
right.
Where I was.
Which one was which.
Right.
That went from being one of the most painful halves of football that I have ever witnessed. Offensively, that was some of the worst football I've ever seen. It went from that to being exciting, exhilarating. Was there anybody in America that was outside of Jets fans and Colin Cowherd that was not pulling for Cleveland in that game? You had to have been rooting for Cleveland towards the end of that, right?
I was absolutely pulling for Cleveland no matter what.
You realize how much it means to them? Like, they stormed into the streets like they won a championship last night.
Yes.
J.R. Smith was shirtless.
We can make fun of Cleveland for celebrating a Week 3 win. I'm not going to. Good for that city. I bet you that felt amazing.
It did. It felt like they celebrated that more than when the Cavs won the NBA championship for some reason.
I bet it wasn't far behind.
Right? Didn't it feel like that?
I bet it wasn't far behind.
They were so amped. The crowd was going nuts. You knew they were going to be drinking Bud Light. Twitter was going crazy for them. There are some days that Twitter, I wonder, like, why am I on this? It seems useless and pointless. And then there's nights like last night when Twitter's a lot of fun.
Everybody's GIFs are going out. And
they had the Browns team. Account had a tweet. Did you see there with the Vince McMahon facial reactions?
I did.
Of the 2-point conversion, and then he perks up, and then it says Browns win, and he's falling over in the back of his chair. It's like, dude, that I love Twitter on nights like last night.
Did you see the Cleveland police?
They
tweeted, oh yeah, Browns win, everybody celebrate. Wait, beer fridge.
Uh-oh.
Everybody be responsible tonight.
Everybody be safe.
That was pretty funny. I was in on Cleveland getting a W. I never like to see some sports cities. It can be funny, and then it's not funny anymore. Like, it's just suffering. And Cleveland football, it's basically been that.
Yeah.
It was funny for a while. It is funny occasionally, but, it's the Browns. Last night was like, dude, I want this to happen. I have no real stake in this game. I didn't bet. Neither are my favorite team. You know, I think Darnold and Baker Mayfield are both going to be good NFL quarterbacks,
yeah,
so whatever. I have no bias there. Just... give the Browns one win, please.
The funny thing, too, is it doesn't really mean that much.
It means nothing.
They get the win, but it's against a Jets team that is not very good. You just call a spade. The Jets aren't very good this year, and they're going to take their lumps with a rookie quarterback. The funny thing is, though, if you wanted to play the what-if game, is that Cleveland could be 3-0 right now.
They very well could be.
They're a blocked kick and a missed PAT away from being 3-0 three games into the season.
Thanks a lot, Zane Gonzalez.
It was, you know, and I know, look, Hugh Jackson's getting a lot of flack post-game.
Well, he should have gone for it on 4th-and-2. That was
he
dumb.
He should have. I'm with
Their
you
defense
on that.
Was shutting Sam Darnold and that Jets offense down.
Yeah, you don't. It goes back to the Doug Peterson philosophy. And Aikman, I think, actually said that on
he
the
did.
Telecast.
He's Peterson would have gone for it.
It's like you can't end a streak by being conservative. And thankfully, they did, and they didn't come back to bite him there. But I would have liked to see him go for it. But I think the aftermath of him making comments in the post game, like, I got to watch the film before I announce who my starting quarterback's going to be, I thought people took that a little out of context.
I did too.
And I think he was just trying to be respectful to Tyrod Taylor and not come out when the guy's in concussion protocol and say to the media and the nation, hey, dude, you're out of a job. Have fun on the bench.
Right.
I thought it was a respect thing. But the only curiosity I would have is how long would he have stuck with Tyrod Taylor in that game?
I honestly, legitimately believe he was going to pull him anyway.
You think after that drive?
Yes.
You had to.
That guy was missing 6-yard passes by 20 yards.
I got into it with people on Twitter this past weekend saying, like, Arizona and Cleveland should both make the move to rookies. And people were saying, Tyrod Taylor's been fine. He's put him in position to win. And he really hasn't. It was completing barely 50% of his passes. And the reason they were in position to win their first two games is because the defense forced 8 turnovers in the first 2 weeks. Their defense was playing lights out football. They weren't getting anything from the offense. And so I'm with you. I'm hopeful that without the concussion, he would have made the move, but I'm kind of thankful that happened because that woke everybody up and it kept people from turning that game off.
We can go with Baker Mayfield and Sam Darnold here in a second, but this was one of my favorite moments last night. So I'm laying in bed. The game's over. I listened to Baker Mayfield in the post game. I realize Reggie Bush is one of the worst things to come to sports television in years.
Joe Thomas is a really good thing to come to television.
Yeah, he needs to be an analyst.
Yeah, he does.
Anyway, so I'm laying in bed. I'm one last check on social media before I do a little night reading. And I scroll and I see this tweet and I'm like, oh, I like this guy. I do a radio show with him. Remember 2 weeks ago when people were making fun of the Browns for passing on Sam Darnold, ? To which somebody responded, and
oh, yeah,
this was
good.
Just amazing.
Yeah, this is good.
Somebody responded to Dirt, remember still today how many people still have no idea who the F Andy Johnson is? F off. And I just thought,
shut the F up!
Is that a SC fan? Is that a Jets fan?
Jets
is that
fan.
A Darnold fan?
See, and the funny thing is, I think he's from New York. He like seeked out my tweet and then
he
responded to it.
He searched Sam Darnold's name
now,
and found your tweet.
I do want to put this into context, though, because I had a couple of people shoot back at me on that tweet. I was not trying to proclaim anything about Sam Darnold sucking or Baker Mayfield being better than him.
Dude, you don't have to explain yourself. These people that misinterpret this to the 10th degree are just morons.
Yeah, it was just simply a basis of, like, people criticized Cleveland for passing on a guy before we had even seen what their rookie can do.
They eviscerated him after that week one win in Detroit.
After the Monday night game, everybody came on the radio, national radio on Tuesday, and said, what were the Browns thinking passing on this guy? Darnold might end up being better. I don't know. But this is why you hesitate on strong opinions. I think they're both going to be good, and I've had that opinion since the draft. It was just fun to finally see Baker Mayfield get a chance to play.
Well, look, I think the culture has said this much about sports media and radio. I did find it funny that Cowherd got a call out last night, and I'm like, you know, you're just helping him, right? Like, if I'm Colin Cowherd and that's
right.
me,
oh, he's eating
I'm
up.
Chuckling as I'm sipping on a cocktail. Like,
thank you for the ratings.
Appreciate you bringing my name up, because now you're just giving more people a reason to tune in tomorrow.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing is I have moments, and this is kind of one of them, where everybody in this industry will tell you, you can't be indifferent. Give an opinion one way or the other. People want it. They want it hard. They want it fast. And they don't care if they agree or disagree. They just want to be able to say something. There are moments where I think that's dumb. And I'm sorry. I think this is one of them. I think Sam Darnold and Baker Mayfield are both going to be really good players.
And they're both going to have really bad moments this year because they're rookies on bad teams.
So, like, this conclusion that people have to jump to, it just cracks me up. And they're literally doing it just because they think that's what's going to take their career farther. I would ask you this, though, because my friend posed this question to me last night.
Okay.
He said, dude, I got Browns mania right now.
How do you not? We all got the Browns.
And he goes, question for you, though. What's more likely? What would you vote as most likely? Baker Mayfield playing that way the rest of his career or Sam Darnold playing that way the rest of his career?
Ooh.
My initial text was, dude, I can't pick. And he goes, false. I need a hot take yesterday. So I gave him an answer.
Sizzler. Sam Darnold playing that way or Baker Mayfield playing that way? That is really...
Don't sit on this fence.
Baker?
More likely Baker
more
Mayfield
likely.
Is pretty efficient and leads to wins versus Sam
Darnold.
Darnold
was pretty bad last night, though.
Right.
That last pick was just atrocious.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, that's I'll side with
the last
Baker.
Pick was a throw, though. He had 20 seconds left.
Yeah, I'll side with Baker because I had the pre-draft opinion. I thought it was totally fine that Cleveland took him number one. I loved watching him in college. I think he's accurate. He's athletic. He can extend plays. He throws a good deep ball, and we saw that last night even though Callaway dropped one of them. And there's just a certain – this is such a terrible cliche. There's just a certain something about him. Like, you could just feel the juice in the stadium. When they took – granted, Tyrod Taylor was about as bad as he could be, but – when they put Baker Mayfield in, it wasn't just the crowd that got into it. It wasn't just the coach that got, like, the entire team, there was a pep in their step. Like, everybody believed, like, all right, we're on to something here.
Do you want kind of a nice opinion that I had?
What do you got?
One game sample size?
Yeah.
It really felt like watching Brett Favre again.
Ooh.
A guy that loves the game.
Yeah, he does.
He's got that fire intensity. He's got a cannon of an arm.
Right.
And the teammates just respond to him because they know he loves all of them. He wants to do whatever it takes to win. I'm not saying his career is going to be Favre.
He did have the draft day photo.
But he, in all honesty, Gene, he kind of has that Favre-esque quality that I loved about Brett Favre. And
he
I wasn't a big Brett Favre guy in the moment.
He'd run around making plays,
yes.
Having fun.
He looked like a guy that understood he was playing a child's game.
Yes.
And he was getting paid for it. And he was just like, this is amazing. I'm going to do this as long as I possibly can.
I'm with you on that one.
All right, let's find out what's on tap for today's show.
Nerd and Sprague know what's brewing.
I'm not paid to be bold. I'm paid to be right.
There's a lot of sporting events that you say, oh, I got to go do that.
This is What's on Tap, poured by Pelican Brewing Company, born at the beach on 1080. The Fan.
What's on Tap, brought to you in the Fan by Pelican Brewing Company, born at the beach, online at pelicanbrewing.com. We'll jump into the Oregon-Stanford game here in a second. Get everybody's thoughts and feelings about that matchup. Mike Parker, the voice of Oregon State football, is going to join us at 12:30. We'll talk to Doc Parker, get his feelings on Oregon State, Arizona. Anthony Newman, former Oregon Duck and pro football player, does pregame show and a little postgame with me and the Ducks Roundtable show on Mondays. He's going to join us at 1 on the horn, and we'll see what he thinks about this matchup. USC and Wazoo is tonight. I want to dive into that one. We may get back into Baker Mayfield at some point. Like, all that game aside, how good could he possibly be? UW-ASU, we'll jump into that. We'll give you our Pac-12 picks. And, of course, we got to Sprague the line. 1-1-1 weekend for me, and Kevin Todd was 0-3.
Yeah, you had a nice little push in that Vikings game.
I did have a nice little push. So that's what's on tap for today's show. We're on Twitter, at Durton Sprague, at Theodore Johnson, at Brandon Sprague. And coming up next, let's just start. Let's go to Eugene, Oregon. How are you feeling, Duck fan, about Oregon's chances to beat Stanford? A lot of back and forth on this one. We'll talk about Oregon-Stanford next. You got Durton Sprague on Football Friday here on The Fan. All right, 12:18. Mike Doc Parker is going to join us, talk Oregon State, Arizona. But let's jump into Oregon-Stanford. It's Friday. Game's tomorrow. Game day is going to be there. We'll have all the coverage here on The Fan. How are we ultimately feeling about this game?
Excited and nervous at the same time. I think this is just the one, when you have an on-conference like Oregon had, this game has been circled on their calendar since the calendars came out, since we knew that they were going to be 3-0 in their first three games. This is when you find out who your football team is. I think it has a chance to be a statement win for them. There's a ton of hype around the quarterback, ton of hype around the coaching staff, ton of hype around the kind of season that they can have. And the hype is great, but at some point you got to go out there and you got to prove it. And they haven't had a chance to do that yet because they haven't played anybody. And finally, you get to see them tested against a top 10 team in the country.
You know, I was going back and forth because I wanted to bet this game for spraking the line. And I think I ultimately am going to put it in there just because it's the big game. It's, you know,
yeah,
national
it's fun
TV,
to do the big
whatever.
Games.
So I was going back and forth and I've heard everybody's opinions on Oregon. I've heard everybody's opinions on Stanford. Every scenario that I'd play this game out in my mind, I just came to conclude that I think Stanford is going to be the winner here. And that doesn't have to be a knock on Oregon. They can still prove a lot after this game, win or lose. Mm-hmm. If they lose, great. Now you get to go down to Cal. You beat what most people think is a more improved Cal team. Then you get a bye and you get to take on Washington at home. And people may dismiss that and say, well, they lost to Stanford. Washington will beat them. If Washington doesn't turn their offense around soon, as good as that defense is, at some point the Huskies are going to put their team in trouble if they can't do anything on offense. So we'll see whether that's at in 3 weeks. But on this game specifically, I thought about the non-conference. I don't think San Diego State, USC, and UC Davis, those aren't the world beaters. But to do what they did defensively against USC, I was still impressed. You take San Diego State, who just beat ASU. I think that's a good non-Power 5 team to go out there and beat. They had a real slow start to that. Price Love was neutralized. And Arcega Whiteside and Costello hooked up a few times. And they won that one by 21. And then even UC Davis. I mean, UC Davis beat San Jose State in San Jose State pretty convincingly. And they didn't have Bryce Love. They still win that game by 20 points. So I'm not taking all of those and concluding that's why I think Stanford's better. I just think Stanford can trust their targets more. I think Stanford has the better ability to potentially run the ball more efficiently how they want. I think Stanford's defense is drastically underrated, and I think they're going to get an opportunity to prove that. And until I see otherwise, that Oregon O-line run game is questionable. The wide receivers, the targets have been dropping too many passes, and I like Justin Herbert. I do. But he can only be as efficient as his targets are at catching the ball. The defensive line for Oregon's good. I just think Stanford has a little more and the David Shaw coaching angle.
I mean, it's a known commodity against an unknown commodity. Stanford is essentially the same team every single season. They play good defense. They're good up front. They run the ball consistently. They struggle at times at quarterback play, but they can make big plays in the passing game. It feels like it's the same team. You roll them out, they're going to go in, you know, 9-3 every single year. They have the coaching advantage. There's no doubt about that. And they've been more tested through these first three games. So I have no problem with people picking Stanford. There's a reason they're the favorite in this one in Vegas. It opened as a pick'em, and Stanford has been, you know, bet to be about a 2.5, 2, somewhere in that range, point favorite in this game. The thing about Stanford I am really curious to see is how their defense holds up, in my opinion, against a legitimate offense. Oregon's going to struggle, I think, to run the ball in this game. I just, until I see them prove otherwise, I'm not going to trust the running game, and maybe they prove me wrong on this week, but Stanford has not faced a potent passing attack yet, and they haven't faced a legitimate quarterback yet.
Is this a potent passing offense?
With Justin Herbert, I do think that it is. Yeah, I know you don't have a number one target, and I know you've struggled with drops to this point in the season, but I still put the faith in Justin Herbert that you put the ball on the money more times than not, your guys are going to come down with it. So in that regard, Stanford has been good defensively, and it's been a surprise how good they've been defensively, but I don't think they've essentially been tested yet. The other aspect of it that I am really curious, because there are matchups that I like and I don't like for Oregon. I do like Oregon's run defense against Stanford's running offense. I hate Oregon's pass defense against Stanford's pass offense. And I really, there's no matchup that can win against Stanford in the conference in terms of a secondary because of how big their targets are. It's not a real good, consistent passing offense. But it's one that is capable of big plays, and it's one that when it's inside the red zone, it's damn near impossible to stop because of how big their bodies are. The one stat that I've kept my eye on, and I think it's going to be a big one this weekend, and it really is in every football game if you want to use it, is Stanford on third down. Because their offense is not a drive in and drive out, we're going to move the ball up and down the field and we're going to beat you up. USC had more first downs than they did, even though they lost the game 17-3. Stanford has been terrible the last 2 weeks on third down. Against USC in that win, they were 4 of 13 in that ball game, and against UC Davis, they were 3 of 14. Against a defense you would think you should have better third down numbers than that. And Oregon, I believe right now, is the second best third down defense conversion rate. Granted, they haven't played anybody. Stanford's a better opponent. But that's one that I look at. I think if Oregon is able to keep Stanford from having big plays and to keep them at least at bay on first down and force them into a lot of second and eight, third and nine, third and seven kind of situations, I do like the defensive matchup in Oregon's favor in this game.
You like the defensive matchup?
I do. I think,
you think Oregon's defense is better than Stanford's?
Not necessarily better than Stanford's, but when you compare offenses, I do like the matchup. I think this is going to be a lower scoring game than people think. I look at the under of 56 to hit in this one.
See, and that's the thing is Oregon-Stanford, they've had it both ways. They've had huge shootouts, and then they've had the 17-14 classic game. The thing I would say, too, on the Oregon defensive line, we know how talented they are. I think the thing that just worries me is Bryce Love getting to sit last week and the fact that they've come close to busting it and haven't quite done that yet. Now, here's an easy way. If David Shaw trusts his offensive guys, he pulls his line a little bit, You put an extra tight end down. If you're smart, you run away from Jordan Scott. That's how you neutralize him. If he's in the middle, don't run that way. Go away from him. Stretch it a little bit and trust your guys are bigger, stronger, and able to move it and create some lanes for Bryce Love. The thing I would say on the passing game, though, is I'm still not sold on Oregon's passing offense. I know Justin Herbert's had a pretty decent start to his season. Didn't look great last week, sure. But I don't know how much I trust it against a proven team. And it doesn't just date back to this year. This is just David Shaw. This is Stanford. I can't just dismiss it and think, well, okay, they did this, that game, this, that game. I'm just going to assume they're going to be good defensively, and I think they're going to be better than what they were last year. I think Stanford's going to hurt Oregon with their targets. I just see it's tough matchups. The bodies are bigger.
Oh, they're bigger and stronger than everybody.
I think they're more reliable, and I've been saying this for a couple weeks now. I think KJ Costello really reminds me of Kevin Hogan. He's efficient. He's not amazing, but you look at his stat line at the end of a game, and he's 17 of 23 for 220 yards and 2 touchdowns. That's who KJ Costello seems to be this year. And I think if Bryce Love can add a buck 40 or more, along with what they do in the passing game, that's where I think Oregon gets in trouble. It's going to be a real interesting matchup because I want to see what Mario Cristobal and Arroyo have planned. How much is that offensive line going to improve? And then what's the plan of attack? Is it different from what we've seen the first 3 weeks? Because the thing about Oregon is, in the past, they may have had the advantage on the hurry-up tempo stuff. They're not really doing that anymore.
Yeah.
They've changed their philosophy. So watching how that new approach works against Stanford is something I'm really fascinated with. Anthony Newman's going to join us at 1 o'clock, so we'll talk more Oregon-Stanford. People texting into the Better You Today text line at 55305, their feelings on it. But coming up next, let's talk to Mike Doc Parker, the voice of Oregon State, and see what he thinks about the Beavs in Arizona. Mike Parker next. All right, welcome back in. Dirt and Sprague with you. Happy Football Friday here on Portland Sports Leader 1080 The Fan. We've talked about Oregon and Stanford a lot, and we've also talked about Arizona and Oregon State, and that's the game we're going to focus on now with the voice of the Oregon State Beavers, Mike Parker, and he joins us on the horn. His Twitter account is at MEPOSU as the Beavers get ready to host Arizona in Pac-12 play. How are we doing, Doc?
Well, I'm doing okay. I hope you guys don't mind. I'm going to try something new in my life, and that as you call your show what you call it. So let me say, hello, Dirt. Hello, Sprague. How are you guys? I don't think I've ever done that before because I sort of prefer the old-fashioned, hey, Andy. Hey, Brandon. How you doing? But Dirt, Sprague, it's good to be on with you.
Let's just go back to the other way, though, because I actually really appreciate that you're one of the three people in my entire life that call me Brandon. My wife doesn't even call me Brandon.
And nobody calls me Andy anymore.
We'll go with Andy Brandon.
Whatever. It'll depend on the mood, and I guess I was sort of in a Dirt Sprague mood and wanted to see how it felt. But we'll see how it goes from here.
Well, you're also the only one, I think, on the planet that calls me Doc, too. Nobody else has ever called me Doc before.
Well, I've never called anyone else Doc, so take that as a compliment.
We're alone in that regard. Okay, good.
How are we feeling about this matchup? Arizona kind of coming in limping, and Oregon State, I mean, you're coming off a heartbreaking loss in which they came back from a 30-7 deficit. This one's been tough for me to try to figure out because I'm playing both scenarios in my mind. How do you feel about it?
I think, Brandon, if they had played it immediately after the game at Mackey Stadium, like, okay, guys, line up. We're going to play another one right now. I'm not sure I would have given the Beavers much of a chance, even if Arizona had just finished off Southern Utah and they both had just played, if you catch my drift. The gut punch was palpable. We could all feel it. It was hard. There were tears in the locker room from players, even some coaches, from what I've been told. It was hard. I mean, they did a great job to come back and play. But I could even tell by the time we got on the bus, by the time we got to the airport, by the time we landed in Eugene and bus back to Corvallis, that the guys were over it in the sense of, okay, let's take the positives and what we learned on both sides of it, really. The positive to be able to dig back from hopelessly down. I had little hope after the scoop and score by Malik Reed and down 30-7. If you would have told me they'll be in a position to win this game on the final play, which they were, I might not have believed you for a moment. They did a great job to fight back. And I think that's been the prevailing mood, guys, that they've taken the positives out of what they did the last three quarters on defense, about how they hung in there with back-and-forth quarterbacks again, to give themselves a chance to win. I think they've taken a lot of positives from it and feel pretty good heading into the game with Arizona.
You know, Doc, whenever you have a new coach, there's going to be tough decisions that they have to make. And I think we always talk about young players making mistakes. And at times, I think coaches going through their first run can make mistakes. And I'm curious, you know, the fans have obviously spoken their piece on the late game execution and the decision to take the knee and not run another play and to not use the two timeouts. So I'm just curious, what was going through your mind when that was the decision from Jonathan Smith? And then what has he said about that decision this week?
Oh, he's been consistent on it, guys. I was reading, I hope you don't mind a little theological talk here for a moment, but I was reading something this very morning about, you know, in the realm of spiritual things, the choice of faith, whether to have faith, not have faith in certain things in the religious realm. You don't know if it's the right choice until you've made it. You know, that was sort of the Kierkegaardian approach. You've got to take a leap of faith and, in a sense, find out if it works for you. If it resonates in your soul, then you've got a chance to live in that world. There are certain choices in sport, in life, but in this particular instance, football, that you don't know if it's the right one until you make it. He missed the kick. Therefore, you could argue just on a, you know, on a pragmatic level, it was the wrong choice because he missed the kick.
Mm-hmm.
I could see what he was doing in the end. I had a momentary twinge about it, to be honest with you, and I wish now, just because of all the second guessers that have come in, that I might have first guessed in the sense of I almost said to Jim, but I stopped short of it because I didn't want to end up being on the, you know, in that dichotomy of saying, well, he should have done this, he should have done that. I felt as though with two timeouts, as close as they were, to maybe take a shot to win it with a touchdown and not let it come down to a kick. I thought it. I didn't say it. I was thinking it, I think, like we all were, for a moment or two. But I could see what the plan was, and they executed that plan perfectly to get into a position to win the game, to center the ball, to give Jordan Shuker, who's been good from inside of 40. Mm-hmm. I think they just believed that he was going to step out there, make the kick, and you wouldn't have to risk a fumbled snap, a turnover. Jonathan said, hey, we turned it over three times. We turned one over in the red zone. We're in a position to win the game with a very makeable kick. I don't blame Jonathan after the fact. Like a lot, it's easy to do. If Shuker makes the kick, most people would, oh, what a brilliant piece of execution. They did everything right. I know that some could say, hey, look, he made the kick, but they should have tried to attack and win it with a touchdown. It's a hard choice. It's a hard choice as the other sort of choice I talked about earlier philosophically. That's a hard choice for some people
right.
to make. That was a difficult choice for Jonathan. But he was consistent in making. He talked to the coaches. He said they talked about it. Well, how do you want to do this? Do we attack? Ryan Lindgren and Jonathan and all the coaches felt good about it. No, let's, you know, in a sense, button it up a little bit. Make sure we don't do anything bad as we've done three other times in this game. Put ourselves in a position to win. We've done that. Let's make the kick and go home with a win. I know that they could have done something else, but he's been very consistent all week and not expressing any sense of regret about the choice that he made.
Yeah. We're talking with the longtime voice of Oregon State Athletics, Mike Parker, on Twitter at MEPOSU. He gets ready to call Oregon State and Arizona this week at 1:00 at Research Stadium to start conference play for the Beavs. This is kind of a tough question to answer, but I'm gonna throw it at you anyway. They went into conference play last year with an identical record. And I know there's a different feeling with the fan base. We've all sensed it on social media. We've all talked to fans in different forms of how they view Jonathan Smith and this coaching staff, where he's maybe going to take this program at some point. But what are the differences you've noticed maybe just being around the team, around the coaching staff, being 1-2 this year versus where they were 1-2 last year?
Part of it, Brandon, is the 1-2 last year was a 1-2 that was barely 1-2. Portland State probably should have won that game. So I get the feeling now you're talking about a 1-2 here where there are a lot of people saying Oregon State, you know, could have won the game and be 2-1. There's just a much different feel about this 1-2 than other 1-2s I've experienced recently. I just think the way they've been able to move the ball, even with some injuries, even with a bit of an unsettled situation, a quarterback, three quarterbacks in one game, no quarterback has gone the distance yet for different reasons. I think that speaks well to the hire that Jonathan, who was an offensive guy, a great quarterback here, and has learned his craft well under a lot of good coaches, Riley and Erickson and Chris Peterson, most notably the last 6 years, calling plays, keeping defenses off balance. He's done all of this through three games at Oregon State, and I think that has given just a much different feel, the ability to score. Now, the defense came to life in the last three quarters. They're going to get better and better as they improve in recruiting, get injured players back. But they're even showing signs of improvement with good coaching going on over there, too. But I just think the fact that Jonathan's offense has been pretty dynamic through three games points to a good hire, in the sense that we hired a guy who's run high productive offenses to come and do that for us here. And even with some injuries, and as I said, the quarterback situation, the Beavers have averaged 527 yards a game, 38 points per game. And that's pretty good, given the injuries and the uncertainty at the quarterback spot.
Yeah, only two games over 30 points all of last season. They've done it in each of their first three games so far this year. So you can see the immediate difference. I do want to ask you about a couple of guys on the offensive side of the ball. They've been so much fun to watch through this non-conference late. The first one is Jamar Jefferson. I want to know when you kind of found out this guy was the real deal and when he was going to be good. And then also this past weekend, how about the revelation that was Isaiah Hodgins on the outside with a huge game? And it was like, there's the big-time recruit I've been hearing about. How fun have those guys been to watch right. So far?
I think with Isaiah, first of all, Andy, the emergence is a function of the improvement on offense and a system and a scheme that features him. We heard, you're right, we heard a lot about what a big-time get he was. I even had some nervousness when the coaching change occurred because, as you know, he and Dave Baldwin, and Dave was the head coach at San Jose State when Isaiah's father, James, played for the Spartans. And so I worried a little bit that Isaiah, with a coaching change and Dave Baldwin no longer on the staff, might get a little unsettled about mm-hmm. that in his own mind. But I talked to him this week, as everybody wanted a piece of him this week after the amazing game that he had. He said that never really entered his mind, that his dad said, hey, this is going to happen in football. It happens all the time. There are coaching changes. You went to Oregon State, no matter who you would be coached by, no matter what the situation was going to be, so hang in there. So he got good counsel from his dad, and then went to work on his craft under a tremendous coach. Tefense Henson, I think, is underrated now. He'll be a well-known entity before it's all said and done as a guy who teach people the craft at wide receiver. He's getting a lot out of, you're right, Andy, the breakout game that we've sort of all been waiting on, two-fold function. The offense knows how to get the ball to him, yeah. And that hasn't always been the case in the last couple of seasons where, the featured guys with talent, the scheme didn't quite offer enough opportunity for a guy like Isaiah. So the opportunity, meeting his own preparation, the excellent coaching, and just the big skill level, I think leads to, I don't know if he's going to go for 14 and 200 again this week or again, but I think he's on his way to the kind of career and productivity that he was touted to bring with him when he first got here.
Where are they at, Doc, with injuries? I know Luton's probably not going to be playing. It probably will be the Connor Blount show, but I know they got a couple other guys. This is around the timetable. People were wondering if they'd come back. Are we going to see anybody that's been injured and hasn't played quite yet back this weekend?
I think it's possible, Doc, that we may see both Trevon Bradford and Noah Tungy. I'm not 100% sure on that, but I think it's possible. It may not, fully in terms of the number of snaps they would normally get when healthy. But just think about that for a moment. I mean, what the Beavers were able to do without Bradford, who had been a big-time guy with three touchdowns in the first two games, get him back into the mix, and a dynamic pass-catching threat tight end in Noah Tungy, I combined with Isaiah Smalls, who showed a little bit of pass-catching ability in Nevada and is improving in the run game as far as blocking. If you get Tungy in the mix, too, and Bradford, and Hernandez, and Hodgins, and the running game, the Jamar Jefferson, you're right about, Andy, to get back to you. Jamar emerged as the camp went along, and certainly the run he had in Columbus, the almost record-setting type game he had against Southern Utah, and mm-hmm. even last week when he was ganged up on and the Beavers had to throw more down 23, he still has a 100-yard rushing game, even with all the attention paid to him. So all of that, and when Artavis Pierce returns later, this offense has moved even without, a full arsenal and been able to be productive and score points. So if you get Tungy and Bradford back, and I have a gut-level feeling we'll probably see both this weekend. I think you're moving in the right direction in offense, for sure.
Yeah. I do want to ask you, Doc, just quickly, because I don't think we've had a chance to have you on since the news came out, but just your reaction to the Pat Casey retirement.
Well, certainly if Pat is at peace with the decision, and I almost use the word if pointedly, because I, listening to him, I've interacted with him briefly since, you know, he has so many people now since the press conference that are wanting to, you know, hang out with him, spend time with him, kind of pick his brain, get a feel for where he's at. I would say that, you know, through the 20 years I worked with him and the 30-some years that I've known him, I mean, 31 years I've known Pat and interacted with him for, you know, over three decades. So I feel pretty close to him. And yet I was, in the end, surprised by the decision, because I thought that even though he was contemplating leaving right after Omaha in the national championship, I thought that that had kind of settled itself. And even in the press conference, you could hear a man still wrestling, it seems, with the decision. And even, you know, a month ago, he went to his assistants and said, I'm done. I'm going to take some time away. I'm going to step aside. He was, as he said, pretty much just talked out of that and was going to stay on. And I wasn't fully aware of all of that behind-the-scenes stuff going on. I just knew that he was grappling with the decision since the end of the Omaha run, but I thought that he had settled in, decided to give it another run, at least one more year this upcoming season. So I don't know how to answer that. I'm surprised on a certain level. I'm disappointed on another, just simply because of what a great coach he is, and how much he'll be missed. You know, by the program this year on the field during games and so on. But I also feel pretty confident that he's handing it off to some pretty good assistant coaches that are, you know, kind of right in step with him as far as approach to the game, the philosophical stuff that Pat has talked and lived out for all these years. I think we'll see that in Bailey and Yeske and Jenkins and Ryan Gibson just hired. I think the program's in good hands and in good shape. But I still have a sense of almost shock that Beaver Baseball, I just can't imagine Beaver Baseball right now without him around in Casey's corner and on the field, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it's gonna be very strange for sure, especially if he stays retired and you get a new era going for Oregon State Baseball. Mm-hmm. Yes or no, Doc, because we're way against it. Oregon State gets their second win of the year on Saturday.
Yes.
There we go.
There you go.
That's what Antoine wanted. He wanted to dive in more, and he said,
to the point.
I'm just going
to
say this, and I'll be done, and I'll let it go. There we go. Mike Parker.
Okay, thanks, guys.
Longtime voice of Oregon State. Thanks for the time, Doc.
Good to be with you, Andy Dirt and Brandon Sprague and Docs. I always enjoy it. Thanks, guys.
There we go. Good stuff. I love Mike Parker. He's the best. All right, let's talk a little bit about this game, because we're up against it.
Can I answer the question like he does? Are they going to win?
I don't know.
Yes. He likes to give thoughtful answers. And in that moment, I think he's like, I can't do it here.
All right.
Is Oregon State going to get their first conference win since 2016 and get their second win of the year? Or was last week just too backbreaking? We'll talk about that next on The Fan. Well, Football Friday is always busy. It's turn and burn. So Anthony Newman will join us here in 10 minutes. We'll get his thoughts on Oregon and Stanford. But Oregon State going for their first conference win since 2016. Mike Parker there, no shocking development. He takes the Beavs, but he does lay out it's not going to be the easiest of tasks.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about that matchup with Khalil Tate and that Arizona offense coming to town against that Oregon State defense?
I it's weird. I feel the same way with Oregon Stanford. You throw me a scenario of Arizona winning, you throw me a scenario of Oregon State winning, I can see either of them happening. And we just, Arizona has been so bad this year through their non-conference slate. It leads me to want to pick Oregon State, but then I feel like I'm getting suckered into that pick.
Right.
When I just look at simply the talent on each roster, I don't think it's really a question. I think Arizona is the more talented football team. I think you can throw your hands up in the air if asked who has the coaching advantage in this one, because Kevin Sumlin has been terrible so far at Arizona, and he hasn't done much in the last decade outside of when he had Johnny Manziel for 2 years at Texas A&M. I am leaning towards Arizona in this game for the Khalil Tate factor. Oregon State's defense scares me. I think they're going to give up a lot of points this year in conference play when they start to play better offenses. And
So this is a get-right game in your mind with Khalil Tate in that offense.
I'll say this. I have now gambled like three straight weeks that they're going to figure it out and start running the football, and they haven't done it yet. So it's almost like I'm going to give you one more chance here, Arizona.
This is it.
This is it. Like if you go through another game where he has less than 10 rushing attempts and you try and make him a pocket passer and he's not escaping and using his legs, if that is the way things go on Saturday, there is no doubt in my mind Oregon State wins this football game because they're limited as an offense with him as a passer. And I think Oregon State's going to be able to put up a good amount of points on that Arizona defense. Whether Jake Luton plays or not.
Jake Luton will not play, by
right.
the way.
Right, and the fear factor I have is if Khalil Tate remembers it, because if he does, Oregon State's defense will not have an answer, and they will not be able to get off the field against that Arizona offense.
You gave me a third down stat for Oregon-Stanford. I'll actually counter you one for this game. I didn't know this till I read about it this morning. Arizona is one of the worst third down defensive teams in the country on third and long situations.
Giving them up.
If it's seven or more yards, which statistically on average is around 30% in the country, they're at 42% giving up third down and long situations of seven or more yards.
That's not good.
But here's the counter to that. Oregon State's 10th on third down conversion. Ooh. So their offense, right. I know in a lot of stats, is number one in the conference, but it's just going to be a matter of game planning in my mind. Like you mentioned it, Kevin Sumlin in that offense. Are they going to actually run Khalil Tate and then flip it? Jonathan Smith, Brian Lindgren, and the offense for Oregon State, can they beat and take advantage of a weak Arizona defense led by Marcel Yates, their D coordinator?
Right.
I don't know. I'm kind of with you. The two home games in the state of Oregon, they just feel like either trap games for the home team or...
Right.
We're not trap, but you know what I mean? Like deceiving games for the home team or... Both teams walk away and we go, chances. Yeah, we should have seen it coming that both could win.
Chances for huge wins for both of them. Oregon State could be 2-2. You kidding me? Nobody saw that coming. And you'd be arguing maybe they should be 3-1. And if Oregon beats Stanford, you're saying, oh my God, can they like contend in the North this year?
It's tough, man.
And they're huge. They're huge moments for both of them. And, you know, somebody's texting in about Khalil Tate's ankle and how healthy it is. Nobody's talking about it. That's
it's
the tough
bum,
thing.
Yeah.
He had. And that's the people are connecting the dots and saying they think that's the reason he's not running the football. And that very well could be the case. And I'll reiterate, if that is the situation and he can't run, and he's in the pocket, this Arizona offense is anemic. There's just something that's fearful for me about a team that has, I feel this way about USC Washington State tonight. It's a team that has their backed up against a wall. Like Arizona came in with high expectations. People thought they can compete in the South, all that stuff. They have been terrible. They were tied at the half with Southern Utah last week. Like at some point, your opportunities are going to run out,
right.
And their backs are against the wall right now.
And which Oregon State defense will you get, first half right. Nevada or second half Nevada? We'll find out on Saturday. Dive into this one a little bit more later on in the show. Loaded second hour. We're going to kick it off by talking with former Oregon Duck Anthony Newman. He'll be on the pregame coverage, and we'll get his thoughts on how Oregon matches up with Stanford. We'll do that next on 1080 The Fan.
Baseball is back, basketball is heating up, and the NFL draft is right around the corner. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app. The biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.